If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
At the end of the day, it was sort of wonderful because we couldn't anticipate exactly what was going to happen. It's not like a prefab building where you try to get everything 100% at the beginning. We were dealing with these very sort of human interventions, and we had to have conversations with one another in the middle of it to deal with it.
We build a lot of tolerance into our drawings. You know, Revit and these CAD programs now, want to get us to the 8th inch or the 16th inch in all our drawings. And we have lots of discussions in the office, please turn that toggle off when you're doing a historic building, because those dimensions don't exist in old buildings.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Justin Crane, FAIA and Principal, and Stephanie Greenfield, AIA Principal at Cambridge 7 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Justin Crane has designed civic, cultural, and academic projects, and his work includes new buildings as well as adaptive reuse and historic renovations, master planning, and urban design. Throughout his career, he has led advocacy efforts from grassroots to the national level to forge a more ethical architectural profession and a more equitable built environment, leveraging outreach, education, and bridging professionals and the public. Justin was awarded AIA's Young Architects Award in 2016 and elevated to the AIA College of Fellows in 2023. Stephanie Greenfield has spent her career with Cambridge 7, advancing the firm's tradition of careful design and collaborative client engagement. She has managed award-winning design for academic, municipal, and hospitality projects. Stephanie leads the firm in historic restoration and adaptive reuse as a steward for sustainable building preservation. Her inclusive and dynamic process engages stakeholders at all levels. Stephanie continues to inspire and nurture talent within the firm and serves as a guest critic at Boston's academic institutions. The project we're talking about today is The Foundry, also in Cambridge. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The Foundry stands as a compelling testament to the power of adaptive reuse, where history and contemporary civic life are carefully interwoven. Originally constructed over a century ago, the 132-year-old industrial building has been reimagined into a vibrant, community-centered destination for arts, education, and innovation.
The older the building gets, and also with an industrial building, the chances of it being manipulated in different ways over the years is even greater. So this building was built in 1890 by the Blake & Knowles Steam Pump Company, and it was built as a foundry. And it has a really unusual sort of double truss heavy timber system. And one of those trusses is there to carry what was advertised as something very innovative for its time, electric powered traveling gantry cranes that could carry up to 35 tons. And those carried furnaces with molten metal that would be poured into casts to make pumps. And it served as a pump making factory for about 30 years before the company moved to the southern United States. After that, it went through a series of uses, including a taxi barn, a truck repair shop, and both in its life as a factory and as a taxi barn, it was cut up and patched and, you know, their additions put on and taken away. So it was, you know, when we found the building, no detail was quite the same as when it was built. And so there was a lot to find in it. And then in the early 1980s, it was renovated to be a telecom building. And it was done in a very insensitive way. So two new floors were inserted into the factory building and, you know, without regard for where the windows were. And then the floor, which it originally been a dirt floor, and that was used for a foundry because it minimized splashing if metal was going to splash out of the cauldrons. And it also just let the metal sink into the earth, which caused problems that we can talk about later. But, you know, when we found the building, it was in a state of disrepair. It had been abandoned for a little while, and it had been totally sort of cut up and carved up from its original design.
And a basement with a garage was also dug out.
Yeah, they dug out a basement for parking. So that there was the basement, and then the first floor at that point was 4 feet above grade level. And there was a kind of a strange little addition that was put on the front with a split level entry, so you could either go down to the parking or up to the first floor.
The project goals emerged from a diverse coalition of voices and stakeholders, shaping a dynamic framework for a program that is deliberately open and adaptable, designed to support a wide spectrum of users and activities.
So the client is actually three different groups. The client is the City of Cambridge, it's the Cambridge Redevelopment Authority, and it's this consortium of a body that came together to start programming discussions. And you have to remember, you know, if you don't know Cambridge, Kendall Square is this area where this industrial complex exists. And over the past 20 years, very exciting development has happened here of, you know, 20-story buildings, lab buildings, research, science, supporting MIT, Harvard, Lesley, all the research institutions. So it's a very dynamic, changing community. And one of the developers gave this building to the city as a zoning compromise. But what really started to happen was, you know, kind of a love letter. This building is like a love letter to the community, because the community always wanted to have their own neighborhood, their own living room within this sea of big buildings. It reminds me of that children's story, The Little House, where, you know, this little house exists, but all the big city is growing up around it. And that's really where this client comes in and spend, you know, we probably spent over a year in community discussion talking about what programmatic elements could go into this building. I will say the City of Cambridge is probably our best client. They're wonderful to work with because they collaborate and they really listen to design teams. But they also really want to give back to the community what is in need. So we can tell lots of stories about how we came up with the programming here, but a lot of it had to do with artists being displaced, artists not having studios to work in, a community of people that wanted startup kitchens or places to work, dance, theater, visual arts, performing arts. All these artists came together and wanted kind of a piece of this project. And the city and the CRA really listened to that group. The goal was to create an independently operated, multicultural, self-sustaining project, meaning whatever programming goes into this building, it had to be self-sustaining. And so from a big picture, that was the goal of the project.
And that led to an interesting program that we had to follow, in that So as part of the stipulation of the developer giving the project to the city, there's an agreement that at least 10,000 square feet had to be dedicated to community use. And we went through a robust planning process to figure out what those community uses were. Stephanie just talked about those. But then on the second and third floor of the new design, there are market rate and nonprofit rate offices. And the profits from those actually go into supporting all the community uses. So there's a lot of different stuff happening inside of the building. And, you know, the big design idea was to get rid of the 1980s insertion that was insensitively done, to restore the original shell of the building, which is 4-wide thick masonry walls, the heavy timber truss structure, one of which supported the gantry crane, the other which supported the roofs. There's a large central aisle, clerestory windows, and then 2 side aisles, all with low slope roofs. So we wanted to restore that shell of the building, and we wanted to restore the original kind of feeling of the industrial space by bringing in a full height space that exposed the trusses into view as soon as you walked into the building. And so a lot of the challenge became, how do we create this insertion that looks like something that was built in 2022 inside of and respecting the historic shell, while also we had to advocate for this full height space, which meant that we were losing square footage while adding a lot of different programs that people have asked for. So that was the central design challenge.
I think that that's a really great point, is also that when we discovered this building, the city had done test fits using these inserted floors. So it really was double the square footage. So we had the task of convincing this client that the spectacle of this space, once we open it up, is what's going to bring people in again. So that was pretty meaningful that they went along with us.
Rather than erasing its past, the design embraces it, retaining roughly 70% of the original structure and allowing the building's industrial character to inform its next chapter.
You know, we wanted to restore the full height scale of the space, and we wanted the place to feel welcoming to everybody. And one move that we had to make for that to happen was to bring the ground floor to grade, so that you wouldn't have to go up or down a stair to get to it. And this building was built in an industrial area that became Kendall Square, which is now famous as a biotech hub, but it was right at the edge of the East Cambridge community and in what was originally wetlands. So we had to do a lot of digging out to get below the 6 to 10 feet of fill that was below the building, and also to remove all the stuff that had, you know, dripped into the, whether it was truck fuel or molten metal from the brass castings. We had to do a lot of work in the ground first, and then provide totally independent structure for everything that we were inserting into the new building and the new floors. And we decided early on that, again, we wanted the new structure to be distinct from the historic structure. So, you know, you mentioned the wood that is so common in Portland, Oregon. This was actually southern pine that had been shipped up. That was the historic. The new is steel, which we looked at heavy timber and steel. Steel priced out better, but it also allowed us to make it very clear what was a new insertion, and that helped get the historic commission on board. All of the new structure was in line with the historic columns. So we used the same structural bay, but the new foundations were all 3 feet away from the historic columns on piles. And then because we wanted to keep the masonry shell intact, we needed to bring that masonry shell up to seismic code. So we have large steel structures at either end of the building, and those are, it's steel that's exposed and been painted, and they're 1/2-inch angle plates with slotted fittings and dowels that had to go a minimum of 13 inches into the 4 with brick walls. So that's a feature in the theater space, which is at one end of the building, and the other side of the building, which is the entrance. And it was how we were able to keep the masonry shell, but also bring it up to code.
For us, and I think we've talked about just celebrating this historic building and celebrating this open space. So for us as architects, you know, to create an all-electric building as well, the kind of story and the design that went together was, if we really want to keep this building intact, if we want to expose all these trusses, if we don't want ductwork running through the trusses, you know, what is our design solution to celebrate old? Well, it was to make something very new, something very different out of a metal enclosure, a metal addition that would, the coloration would speak to some of the casting and the metalwork that happened in this historic building. So we put on a new addition, and in that new addition would be our transformer vault, our elevator, our egress stairs that meet code. And so it was a really intentional dialogue between the historic building and this new addition that could serve all our modern functions. And I think that was a technical challenge and an opportunity for us as well that was pretty successful.
Embedded within the architecture is a recognition of the people who shaped the site's history. A permanent exhibit commemorates the nearly 2,000 immigrant laborers who once worked there, many of them women, ensuring that their contributions remain an active part of the building's narrative.
There were a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and on top of that, there was pressure by the city to make this sort of a demonstration project for their values, whether it was stormwater collection or zero parking. So, you know, encouraging multiple modes of transit, and of course, how the city works with historic preservation and their attitude towards that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the success stories of the project in working with the local AHJ and the team was, from day one, we partnered with the Historical Commission. So we did not approach this project as, here's the building, this is what we're doing. It was, hey, Charlie Sullivan, bring your team over. Let's talk about some of our attitudes about the building. And we really listened to what the Historical Commission had learned from this building as well. Because they spent, the City of Cambridge Historical Commission is a very smart, thoughtful team of people. And we knew we would learn a lot just sitting with them. So they were thrilled at the redevelopment for this project. And at the same time, they taught us an immense amount about the building and also where we could be creative. You know, they did not shy away from this new addition. They did not shy away from Lustrup, you know, this kind of sculptural entry piece that we put on the front door. They did not shy away from some of the graphics and wayfinding we have here. They really wanted it to be a demonstration of how a historic building could come to life for the next 100 years.
Yeah, so we invited Charlie Sullivan, the executive director of the Historical Commission, to our office multiple times. He took part in design charrettes. And, you know, one of his big goals was that the new parts of the building be distinct from the historic parts of the building. So it tells the story. And in terms of telling the story of the building, the other key piece is this building played an important role in the women's labor movement. So in 1912, it was the location of labor action on site because there are a lot of women working in the factory. I think half of the people working there were immigrant women, immigrant men. There's a large immigrant community in East Cambridge. At the time, most of them were Polish and Portuguese. And women were doing the same heavy, hot work as men, and they were being paid half the amount. And so as a result of some labor action, some investigations, the state legislature actually passed the first minimum wage act for women in the country. And that's a story that we want to tell together with the architectural stories. And so we worked with the Historical Commission on an interpretive graphic that's actually one of the first things that you see when you come in. It covers an entire wall. It tells the story of the women's labor movement. It tells some of the architectural story of the building, and then it connects it to what's happening in the building today, which again, the program has spaces for making and STEM learning. And it's a place for the community. So, you know, the text acknowledges that women are still underrepresented in the STEM industries. And, you know, the hope is that the building can do its part to right that. But the other thing that nobody anticipated when we were talking about the program in 2018 was COVID. And this building opened right in the middle of COVID when nobody was coming into the office and nobody was leasing new office space. Partly just because it was depressing to go to places where nobody was. And, you know, we all know the stories of what's happened to financial districts. But this building actually rented out very quickly. And we believe that part of the reason was because everybody comes in through the community hall, and including people who work in the offices. And so you come in and there's this activity surrounding you of, you know, community members and people making things. And you can look down onto the community hall through the glazing that surrounds it. You can look down through the glazing from the office spaces and you feel like you're part of something bigger going on. And I think that was attractive to the tenants that moved in.
The site required extensive remediation from the historic industrial site, including the removal of hazardous materials and clever reorientation.
There's not only the fuel that spilled from the trucks and the metal that spilled from the furnaces, but, you know, fill is interesting in Boston because people just used whatever was in a hand. So, you know, you'd find pieces of wood from old carts or bricks from other buildings that were demolished. And so we had to get rid of all that. It was also very much an industrial site in that the south side of the building was an old kind of industrial private way. And that's the side of the building that faces Kendall Square. The north side of the building faces East Cambridge, the neighborhood. And the challenge was, how do we make this feel like a building that belongs to the neighborhood while still taking advantage of all of the, you know, innovation and activity that's happening in Kendall Square? So, and one other thing that was happening nearby is that the city was building a new park and we wanted the building to connect to that. So we advocated for turning this old kind of industrial back alley into a shared street with new paving and rain gardens, and actually extending that paving all the way, you know, another half a block to an intersection with this park. And the other challenge is, now that we've decided that we're going to make this back alley the new entrance, we don't want the neighborhood to feel like we've turned our back on them. And so there was sort of an abandoned little yard that we named the yard and provided a kind of a gateway entrance through that from the community side, so that there was a kind of a beautiful entrance that the community could use from the north to get to the main entrance.
Was getting the hazardous materials out of the ground, did you have to do anything special or did you just have to dig it all out?
It's a very special process here. It's very laborious. It has to be calculated. You know, it's all got to be shipped to different areas. So I don't want to minimize it, but it, you know, what Justin was talking about, digging these foundations, digging the grade beams for the new steel structure and the new insertion, that lasted a long time. And the removals lasted a long time. And outside, I think, in this yard that we created, that's where all our runoff water is going. So even within this small 15-foot wide space, we have a series of infiltration pipes running through there as well. And all that waste had to be carefully removed. So every inch of this site was used. You know, there was no area that wasn't touched. I mean, everything was redone.
At the heart of the exterior is a careful interplay between old and new. The original brick envelope and heavy timber structure establish a strong architectural foundation, while contemporary insertions introduce clarity and openness.
One of the architectural goals of the building was to expose as much of the original architecture as possible, including the masonry on the walls. And of course, we had to keep the masonry exposed at the exterior. We also had to restore all the fenestration patterns, which was a process because, again, they had been bricked up and replaced and modified over time as industrial sheds had been added and taken away. We looked at historic photographs to figure out what the original kind of patterning was on the first floor windows. And it was this very unusual 10/8/8 pattern of the window sashes. So we recreated that with new aluminum clad wood windows. And we also wanted to expose the brick on the interior. We thought that was really going to, you know, set the feeling of the space. But we had to do a lot of work with our engineer, with AKF, and with our envelope consultant, SGH, to figure out if that was going to be possible to meet the energy requirements. And one thing about the brick and the mortar on this building is that it was unusually soft, even for a building of the 1890s. And we wanted to make sure that we were not adding insulation to the point where it trapped extra condensation inside of the masonry wall. And in addition to that, we determined that we actually could meet energy code, and we could meet a low target EUI of 30 by providing R40 insulation on the roofs, because it is such a horizontal building with the low slope roofs. And so we chose not to provide new insulation or new finish on the brick. We were able to keep it exposed, and we cleaned it up, repointed it where we had to, but otherwise we were able to keep that exposed. We also had to restore the windows at the clerestory level, which is above the where the gantry beam is and the upper roof. So we restored those windows, provided new insulation at the upper roof, and we also strengthened some of the trusses on the upper roof so that it could carry new solar panels. And then we added skylights. So originally there were skylights in the building. They had been either closed up or replaced with a different
kind of
bubble. Yeah, it was a cow wall skylight. And so we wanted to provide new skylights that had the original profile, as in kind of low to the roof. And we used a panelite material that has sort of a honeycomb between two layers of glass so that we could actually control how light was coming into the space, because we didn't want so much light coming in that people in the offices would be blinded by the glare, but we also wanted to make sure that some light was going all the way down the community hall.
The roof also underwent a transformation, not only with the replacement of eroded material, but also the preservation of as much historic architecture as possible.
When we came to the building, it was just an asphaltic roof. It was a low slope roof. The only charge from the Historic Commission is that we keep the dark color. So at the end of the day, we provided an EPDM, a dark colored EPDM roof, 6 inches of polyiso. Well, so it was EPDM, a protection board, 6 inches of polyiso, and then 5/8 inch plywood. And then below that is the historic decking, and it's 3 inch deep historic decking. The goal was to keep as much of it as possible because it's exposed on the interior and it's, you know, it's an important part of the feeling of the space. This was one surprise that we came across, is that more of it was rotted away than we had hoped, to the point where some subcontractors said, "I'm not walking on that roof because I don't want to fall through the building." And so we actually, again, had to get the contractor and the structural engineer together, have conversations about what to do about this. And we came up with this metric in which, so the rotted boards, obviously those would be taken away. The problem became when the truss structure that the decking is spanning between, when those the truss structure was rotted away, we had to do testing to see whether if the rotted part went 2 inches deep into the truss or took away more than 5% of the cross section of that truss, that's when we determined that it needed to be strengthened and the decking around it replaced. And then we went through a big process of finding stain that would match the historic to minimize any, so it would not be clear to visitors what was new and what was historic.
The interior is organized to encourage flexibility and interaction, accommodating a wide range of uses within an open framework. Makerspaces, artist studios, performance areas, and classrooms are woven together to support both individual creativity and collective exchange.
So this building, I'm looking at the atrium photo right now, and you can see that we had a cafe in here at one time that was going to be independently operated by another group. We had meeting space, we had wood shops, we had textile shop, metalworking. We have a dance studio. We have a theater that's a flexible theater. It can be a black box theater, or it can all be opened up and be a kind of performing arts classic theater. We have risers in here so we can do music venues. The atrium itself is designed to be a big public event space, a big spectacle space. We have flea markets that go on in here. We have family and community dining that happens in here. We have weddings that happen in here, not too many. On the second floor, there's an open gallery space for the art community. And then you can see on levels 2 and 3 are these market rate offices that Justin was talking about. I think one of the fun things that came out of this project, Justin, I think you talked about the office space, is that when we first started the project, we designed levels 2 and 3 to be open, that you would walk around an open hallway and you could hear the sounds from the atrium migrating up to level 2 and level 3. And I think when we got a real estate broker involved, their feedback to us was, no way. No way are we going to be able to lease this space if there is no acoustic privacy between the upper floors and the lower floor. So we actually had to scramble in the middle of design to come up with a solution to enclose the upper floors acoustically, but then figure out the egress paths and the interior planning a little differently. So that was a big change that happened kind of halfway through the project, to enclose the upper floors.
But it's also something that's become a major design element. So it's a beautiful ash wood storefront by Duratherm, and it's double glazing, which helps with the acoustics. And then it is a corridor, so there's the double glazing at the community hall, a corridor, and then the offices. So that corridor also provides additional acoustic separation. But you know, that wood storefront accentuates the verticality that we were so interested in when we first came to this project. Another program element that is really fun in this project is public art. So the city has a 1% for art requirement, in which any development, 1% of the project cost has to go towards public art. And in this case, Stephanie was very involved in a selection committee that eventually chose Elisa Hamilton, and she came up with this great idea to renovate a 1950s jukebox. So she gutted the jukebox and put new innards in it, similar to what we did with the building. And instead of playing music, it plays recorded stories of that people tell of growing up and living in Cambridge.
In East Cambridge, yeah.
And so there's a little nook that we built just off of the community hall where you can sit and listen to this jukebox. And there are also places around the city to record your own stories.
And then we have just an entire room dedicated to independent artists. So there are studio, and this was a call to the community to that artist studio space was really needed here. And so one room is just full of 10 different alcoves that artists can set up in. And then I think it's a yearly rotation they're on. They're allowed to apply to be here and then stay and contribute.
And that's part of the project that was built to be changeable. So we built a low wall in the middle of the room that had power and data. And then the artists would come in. They had a little, you know, space that had been drawn out on the floor, and they could build whatever they want next to this low wall with power and data. And that wall is actually being extended now because the program is so popular. But that was a big challenge to this project too, is how do we build in the flexibility that artists are going to want? Because we know that once artists come into this building, they're going to
do whatever they want.
They're going to do whatever they want.
A variety of finishes were employed to bring a universal warmth to such diverse community spaces within the building.
Just first to pick up on the challenges of building this interior storefront, you know, part of the reason we wanted to do it and we were able to convince the owner to do it is that We wanted to be able to see the roof trusses beyond that wall to understand that the original width of that central part of the building was wider. So glazing was a key part of that. It was also a key part of making the building feel welcoming. And like everybody there is part of one community, there, you know, were the challenges in convincing the owner to do it. There are also the challenges with the AHJ. And if you look really closely at this image, you can see that there are sprinkler heads that are actually embedded in wood soffits just outside the windows. So we needed sprinkler heads at each of those window panes. And we had to work really hard at the sides to hide the sprinkler lines behind the trusses. And yeah, it was all totally worth it in the end. But the other, you know, the big idea here was that the new finishes be clearly distinct from the old. So we chose ash because it's a clearly different color from the southern pine that made up the trusses and the roof decking.
I think for us, one of the biggest challenges on the interiors was that we had a client, we had lots of clients with lots of ideas. And at a certain point, we had to put our designer hat on and make some choices on their behalf, because when everything's flexible and open and no one really wants to commit to a room being for X or Y or Z, at some point, I think we started to curate what had to happen here, because I think the fear was if we didn't put our hand down and say, we're going to design it to a certain level, on opening day, it could have been felt like a garage. And I think for us, part of the environmental graphics that we started to introduce to the interiors really set a tone for creativity, but it also started to thematically remind people of where they were. So we took this font, Druck was sort of a sans serif font that was used back in the day, and we tried to pump it up in a bold way to use it as the numbering system for the rooms. We started to name places in the building, a pump cafe, a steam set, I think we had a name for the food lab. You know, giving names to spaces started to help give identity as well. Putting some of these graphics on the floor started to animate the atrium as well. And those were supposed to be motifs of nuts and bolts that could have happened, you know, in the industrial period. So part of the interiors was introducing a language of color, reds and golds that were had an industrial spirit, but also some of the naming of places. And over time, we've watched them kind of translate what these are in a fun way. But on opening day, it was pretty joyful.
Beyond all modern tools of design and communication, collaboration often relied on good old-fashioned face-to-face interactions or picking up the telephone.
We have multiple project management tools that we use. Newforma, run Microsoft Teams. The construction administration was on Procore, but what we found to be the most effective was the old-fashioned just pick up the phone and call the people that you need to talk with about something, especially because we were coming across so many kind of unusual one-off details that we needed to have those conversations.
I mean, I'd even riff further on that, you know, this was an existing building. So we demanded that people actually come to the site and meet us and look at stuff. I think we've gotten so used to sitting and working, but in this case, we had an existing building and it was very easy to go visit it and go look at challenges. A lot of the challenges had to do with MEP work and ductwork and condensate lines. You know, these were robust systems that just couldn't be left to chance. And we had a young woman in the field every day working tirelessly with those teams, showing them, here's the truss. I don't want to hit the truss. I want to miss the truss. And really collaborating with them on how to best do that.
And as we mentioned before, the construction happened during COVID. So I think we were all kind of happy to get out of our houses, have an excuse to go see other people.
Yeah.
The project necessitated innovative solutions for implementing MEP systems within the historic framework without drawing attention to them.
The dance studio photo, I think, is a great example of how hard we worked to come up with a language in the building that could be storage. We came up with these storage locker ideas. Everyone needs storage in their flexible rooms. And then we built in a continuous ductwork on top of it, because the real goal, and I think we talked about this, was not to run ductwork, piping, or lines through the trusses. We kind of created some rules for ourselves. We could run parallel to trusses, but we don't want to run through the truss. And that's how we found the building. We found the building with all these 1970s ducts running and being threaded up and down through the trusses. And we knew to celebrate the building would require some really careful planning about how to decouple the mechanical systems from the historic structure.
The millwork cabinets that Stephanie just referenced that you can see in the dance studio and in the classrooms and the maker spaces, some of those were storage, but one of those holds a heat pump with an acoustic door. And then the, you know, the line sets and the ductwork comes up from that. So we were able to get everything low, which kept it away from the trusses and closer to where people are, to get people more comfortable more efficiently.
Sustainability is woven into the project's foundation, driven both by the rigorous energy standards mandated by the city and by the intrinsic efficiencies of adaptive reuse, culminating in LEED Gold certification.
Ironically, LEED, what we're learning now is that many of our building codes obviously have ratcheted up, especially in Massachusetts. We have really strong energy code here. And so just meeting the building code here helps us with LEED. That may not occur in other states around the country, but, you know, this is an adaptive, reused historic building. That's probably the one of the best ways we can care for our environment, right? We're using an old building. We didn't introduce any new. So some of these things are sort of the soft measures, right? We didn't introduce any new parking. We reused the historic building. We thermally sealed the entire envelope with new windows and the new roof and the new insulation. So the percentage of those goals gets us to some of those target goals. And it's an all electric building. So, you know, just taking those bites gets us almost 60% of the way there. You know, we can talk about material choices or other choices, or, you know, there's not a lot of plumbing in the building. There's just the restroom. So I do think Massachusetts is pretty aggressive, and Cambridge is as well. Just for us to meet the building code, we were halfway there.
And again, we were sort of lucky with this building in that it's so horizontal that providing robust insulation on the roof was able to help us meet our energy codes. And the addition that we were able to build to capture all of the program that Stephanie mentioned earlier, that was also built as a new building to, you know, with energy code required tightness and insulation levels. So that portion of the building also helped us meet our energy goals for LEED. But it's really, you know, this being at an urban site, reusing a historic building gets you a lot of the way there.
The truss structure and its various renovations over time, as well as antiquated dimensions overall, created unexpected design challenges.
When it was originally built in 1890, it was a very rational truss structure. But as I've mentioned, it got cut up and redone, and there are new insertions put in along the way. And when we came to the building, and as we uncovered more and more, we realized none of those connections were like they originally were, and none of them were like each other. So it becomes this very quirky building. And if you look closely at some of the photographs, you can actually see where we cut away the steel and concrete structure that had been inserted in the 1980s. And at the end of the day, we just had to embrace all of these weirdnesses of the building. We didn't try to hide them. Similar to the plywood I mentioned when we started talking, you know, we didn't try to paint them to hide them. We didn't try to clad them. We just left them as part of the story of the building. And obviously it took these conversations between us and the contractor and the structural engineer to figure out what could we leave in place? What was the value of actually removing any of them? But at the end of the day, it was sort of wonderful because we couldn't anticipate exactly what was going to happen. It's not like a, you know, prefab building where you try to get everything 100% at the beginning. We were dealing with these very sort of human interventions, and we had to have conversations with one another in the middle of it to deal with it.
I mean, I think another thing that, I mean, I think as Cambridge 7 does a lot of historic and adaptive reuse projects, I think what we always try to do, well, we do two things. The first is we really encourage the client to open up the building before we even start design, so we can minimize some of these unexpected hiccups. That's been pretty successful. And the other is we build a lot of tolerance into our drawings. You know, Revit and these CAD programs now, you know, want to get us to the 1/8 inch or the 1/16 inch in all our drawings. And we have lots of discussions in the office, you know, please turn that toggle off when you're doing a historic building, because those dimensions don't exist in old buildings. And so what we really try to do is build a lot of tolerance into, we never try to sister things very tightly or closely or precisely. We're always trying to work into the design a lot of space for something to bow or slope or bend. The 20-foot grid might not really be 20 foot in the field. It might end up being, you know, 21.6. So I think that's something we do as architects internally that's actually helped to mitigate some challenges in the field.
And I mentioned the 3-foot distance that we kept between the new structure and the historic structure. And that was based on a worst case scenario. So the historic structure is on granite piles. And again, that granite was just piled up based on the stones and the masons who were doing it. Every piling was different. So we had to keep the new structure, you know, a minimum distance away from the historic, but we couldn't, you know, we didn't know exactly what we were going to find as we dug up those granite piles.
Much like the design phase, construction required navigating a series of unforeseen conditions and idiosyncrasies layered within the historic structure, each revealed as the building was carefully opened up.
W.T. Rich was the contractor, and again, they were great to work with. They came onto the project as a construction manager, and we, you know, worked closely with them to uncover as much as possible. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's still surprises, as there always are, and that's what keeps it exciting, right? And like, there was one part at which I think to make it possible to walk from one part of the building to the other, somebody just cut one of the cross beams from the historic truss. And it became this sort of, this you know, we had to answer very quickly. If the building is entirely open and we don't have the 1982 slabs for lateral stability, do we need to reconnect these parts of the trusses? And then how do we do so in a way that was sensitive to the original, but is also clear that it's a modern intervention? And we ended up designing a steel connection detail, painted that steel the same color as the steel columns that you can see in the community hall. So again, it was a record of when this work had been done on the building. So a lot of judgment calls like that. There was one place where we came across a truss that had been painted white. I don't know why, somebody had an idea at some point. And in that particular room, we decided, let's just run with it. And we painted the decking white as well, so that the entire ceiling became white instead of the original stain that was there.
Problem solving skills, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of improvisation.
Improv. And also sometimes we just sit back and just say, these guys just know what they're doing. We had an amazing masonry contractor. Half this project was restoring the masonry on the envelope and patching and filling windows. And at one point, you know, we just sort of said to each other, let's just ask the mason, what do you want to use? What do you suggest? They came out, they were happy as clams because, you know, this is what they do and they do it best. So we just sort of sat back and listened to their ideas on mortar color and the brick finish. So a lot of times, again, we just learn from these guys who are experts in their fields.
For Stephanie and Justin, the commitment to adaptive reuse served as a guiding principle throughout the project, informing decisions from inception through completion.
I think it goes back to the basics. You know, we had a big idea and we just tried to always go back to what that big idea was. And I think sometimes we forget in this business, you know, we have so many tools, we have so many specialists, we have so many consultants, we have so many conversations, we have so many people in the design team, and always just reminding ourselves of what our idea is and how to implement it. I still think the basics of architecture live best that way. So I think opening up that atrium hall, exposing the historic structure, all came to fruition, and we just had to keep reminding ourselves that was always the goal.
And I think if that idea is strong enough, then if people come in and muck with your building a little bit after they move in, it's fine. And it actually can make the building better in this case. You know, it's a building full of creatives and community members with a lot of ideas. And so, like in the wood shop, they built some furniture that they've inserted into part of the community hall. And it's wonderful. They've used a space that we had provided, but, you know, they've fully used it. And then, you know, the graphics, the super graphics that Stephanie talked about earlier, there's one, most of the numbers are black. Originally they were black, but there's one where an artist has painted this sort of fantastical rainbow scene within the number. So they've kept the font, they've kept the shape, but they've turned it in their own, and it's sort of magical, actually.
The Foundry operates less as a singular building and more as an evolving platform, one that supports creativity, cultivates community, and demonstrates how thoughtful design can bridge past and present while remaining resilient for the future. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. One of the biggest issues architecture firms face in 2026 is that experienced professionals are retiring faster than they can be replaced, creating a severe skill gap. I was curious if Justin and Stephanie have seen this trend personally and what advice they might have to deal with it.
Well, in terms of hiring, it is trickier now because of some things happening at a national level, really. You know, immigration policies have made it more difficult for skilled professionals to come into the country. And a recent decision by the education department that architecture wouldn't be classified as a profession, and therefore it would be harder for architecture students to get loans, that's going to make it even more difficult to hire talent. And so we are definitely seeing trickiness in hiring at that point. And Boston is expensive. So finding people that live close to the office is difficult.
Cambridge 7, you know, we've been in business over 60 years and have a long legacy. And I will say that we must be completely unconventional because we have employees who stay. And we like to think we're a big family, but we really don't lose. We don't have a lot of attrition. And so happily, we have such a lineage of really impressive, thoughtful, older architects here who are really mentoring younger architects. So I think we are a bit of a beta case on how to run a successful architecture firm because we are so blessed to have a lot of experience in this office. And it's kind of a blessing, but we appreciate what's going on nationally.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nice place to be. So yeah, for better or worse, people don't leave.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Justin and Stephanie. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
You know, I think the Foundry is actually, it does a couple of things that I would love to continue to do, which is making spaces that inspire people to be creative and making a space that makes people proud of their neighborhood and their community.
I think just staying curious and asking questions and not making assumptions about what someone wants or what someone needs or how someone feels. I do think that being curious keeps you young and nimble and also allows you to be a good designer and a good parent and a good friend. So I hope I stay curious, and I hope young people in the office will take that away as well.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.